going deep. I feel like Kalo on the Miami Heat. The words I speak off this sheet are like a three-peat. I don't just hop on a track, I bring running cleats. I'm a player for real, more than an athlete. Let my mama tell it, could have ran for the Senate. Instead I penned it for Donovan Bennett. I'm cemented, this a deep dive. In your headphones or a long drive, up close and personal, just like you courtside. There ain't no out of bounds here, no offsides. We going live in 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. You are now tuned in to Going Deep with Donovan Bennett.
That's right, Capital. It is the Going Deep podcast. I am Donovan Bennett. We're going to go deep on a couple things. We got some soccer action. We've talked a lot of NSL on the podcast of late, and we still will, so stay tuned. Please like, favorite, share, and subscribe. I'm going to talk some CPL later as the season is finally here, but the baseball season is here. Great start for the Blue Jays. Great start for the best teams in the NL West. But great start for anybody who has a torpedo bat. Sure, you've now heard and seen the craze. If you have a fantasy team just of players using a torpedo bat other than maybe the Blue Jays' Davis Schneider, then you're in a great spot, especially if you have someone like Jazz Chisholm Jr., who started using a torpedo bat at the end of spring training and now already is a diehard. If you haven't, for some reason, heard about the craze, essentially it is just moving some of the wood closer to the handle where people get jammed up. And if you have a bigger surface area, a bigger sweet spot, if you will, then theoretically better chance for you to make hard contact and thus for the ball to travel farther, which we are seeing in record numbers, at least if you're a Yankee fan. This concept that was developed by an MIT physicist who's transferred to baseball, spent some time with the Yankees, now with the Marlins, well, it's really benefiting said Yankees. Opening day weekend, in the first three games, they hit 15 home runs, including in one game, a team record 9 home runs. So some people have some concern. What is this going to do for the over-under betting numbers and season line totals? Because obviously you can adjust as we go through. I think that's a weak concern because when you look at last year, only 7 players, I believe, hit over 300. We like offense. Chicks dig the long ball was a real marketing slogan. Hasn't really stood the test of time because, one, people don't really talk like that, and two, because it's not actually true. There aren't a lot of long balls. So I'm all for it, but I also want to know how we got here, what the impact is, and what does it mean for our Canadian bat makers? In Quebec City, you have Bass 45, and in the Ottawa area, in Carleton Place, Ontario, you have Sambat. And so I decided to talk to their Canadian director, Ben Milinkovic, to talk about the torpedo bat craze, the demand, exactly what is it, how quickly they can turn around, and is it legal? Let's go deep on the torpedo bat. So Ben, I am not able to escape all things torpedo bat on my timeline, in my group chats, and you literally are creating them and servicing them. Let's go back in time. How long has the torpedo bat been inquiry for you, and when have you started creating them and servicing them for players?
So they've gone back all the way. There's some that are as old as the 90s and in the early 2000s, but obviously they're a little different now. They've obviously taken off big time in the last week, really. But they've been kind of around in the pros since a little bit last year, and then more so around this spring training. And then now in the last week, they've absolutely blown up. But there's some models that have been around since kind of the mid-2000s that we've done that have the smaller kind of version of the torpedo, where it does get bigger in the middle in the sweet spot area and then tapers off a little bit. But the ones that are out in the market now are a little bit more drastic than that. They're really kind of maximizing the middle part and then tapering off even more. So in the iteration that's out there now, they're really, they kind of touched a little bit last spring, but have really taken off kind of more this spring training.
And take us through some of the clients that you would service at the major league level, and how often would you create something new or unique for them on demand?
It really changes player to player. So, I mean, we have roughly 100 players in the MLB every year or so that swing our bat. Some players, every single order for the last 5 years has been the exact same thing in one of our standard models. So they're pretty easy and they're kind of easy to take care of. And then there's other guys that have every kind of 2 weeks, they'll order something different with a little tiny bit of a change here, a little bit tiny bit of a change there. So we do quite often have to make new models on the fly. Never quite to this extent where there's so many guys looking for kind of the same thing all at the same time. But little tinkers here and there and changes in models is quite common. So our team is really good at doing that quickly as well. It's basically our master bat creator, Scott. He does all the drawings for all the bats, and he's able to kind of make the computer program change it. Even we're down to 1/100th of an inch people are changing. So it's literally changing the barrel or the handle or something on the knob 1/100th of an inch. And that these players are so kind of in tune with the tool that they use pretty much every day that they can feel that 1/100th of an inch makes that big of a difference. But there's never been a wave like this where there's this many at one time all trying to change to some little thing. So it's definitely kind of taken the baseball world by storm.
So what was the wave for you and your company? I assume it started after opening day or opening day weekend. What was the increase in demand for you? And then what did that mean for you in terms of manufacturing and having efficiencies to get those bats out?
Yeah, so it was really, I was out during the Yankees game, and then I go back home and check my phone, and I have like 5 missed calls, 30 texts, so many emails. So it really did take off as soon as kind of the Yankees went off on Saturday. And then between Saturday and now, it's been just nonstop phone calls, emails, texts. Like if I went back through my phone, I probably have couple hundred different people have reached out about these things, anywhere from the MLB level all the way down to we have dads asking us to make them for their 8-year-old. So it's really anywhere from kind of little league all the way up to MLB pros that want to try this thing. We'll see how many actually stick with it and take off, because it's not something that's going to be the magic fix for everyone. It's going to be some people like it, some people don't. So obviously we're at the peak interest right now, but in terms of production, it's it is challenging because the torpedo barrel is kind of the same. Like for all the other models, every barrel is a little bit different, has some different characteristics. So it comes out of kind of the whole wood supply, but because the torpedo barrel is pretty similar on all the different models, the weights that they're coming out of is a little bit challenging production wise, because you get this big array of weights in of the wood, but if it's all coming out of the same kind of segment, it's tough to use all the wood segments. So we're in the battle of kind of having enough wood to do all this orders and meet all this demand, but we're in a good spot right now. We have more wood coming in like we always do. I mean, this is our busy time of year, regardless of all the torpedo stuff. Kind of March through May is our peak production season anyways. So it's increased demand in torpedo bat, and certainly increased demand overall, but it is our busy season, so we're ramped up, ready to go for kind of however many bats come through. But the interest is certainly at its peak, and we're definitely making a lot of these things over the last week, and we still have probably a couple hundred on order to make, at least, if not more.
So there's increased demand in terms of having a torpedo bat, or what people think is the new wave. What do you have to do in terms of education and help to make sure that you're making these bats legal for people to be able to use?
So it really ranged. So MLB has emailed all the bat makers saying the shape itself is approved. As long as it meets all the other regulations that we have to do with for the bats. I mean, there is a max size it can get to. There's certain weight dimensions that it has to meet if it's maple versus birch. So there is still tons of regulations that we do have to follow, but the shape itself is approved. And pretty much every other league in the world goes from the MLB. So if it's approved at the MLB level, then it's really going to be approved at any other level. So as of now, we got the go ahead. I think MLB has already started kind of a study on them to make sure they're big. Concern or not concern, but the only reason that it wouldn't be approved, if for whatever reason, because of the shape of them, they lead to more breakage. which would be a safety issue. That would be the only reason that the MLB would take them off the field. So they've already started kind of tracking who's getting torpedo bats versus regular bats. And then they, for years, they've already tracked every single broken bat that happens in MLB game gets recorded for safety purposes, for kind of for us as bat makers. We have a meeting at the end of the year every year with all the stats about certain profiles break more, certain types of wood break more, certain players break more, just depending on how their approach is at the plate. So the only reason that these would get taken off the field is if that it turns into a safety issue via breakage. So if they say that the shape is causing the bats to break more, then they'll have to take them off the field or adjust them in some way that that negates that. But I foresee this being totally approved for forever, and so it'll be approved everywhere if it's approved at the MLB. So we're not too worried about it not meeting any standards of any other league and anything like that.
So understand what you're making, understanding who your clients are. The other thing that makes me curious is where your clients are. How many are looking for your bats domestically here in Canada? How many are abroad? And with that, given the ongoing conversation around tariffs, is a company and a business like yours one that could be susceptible to having to feel the geopolitical climate that we're in right now?
So yeah, we ship worldwide. Like we're actually the number one North American brand in Japan as well. So we do tons overseas. We do our biggest client is the United States, just because that's kind of where the mass of the baseball population is. So USA is certainly number one, but we do lots in Canada, obviously, tons in Japan, Korea, Taiwan, Australia. So we really are worldwide. So obviously all those are kind of, as of now, free of all the geopolitical stuff, especially the Canadian stuff. So sales in Canada have increased over the last little bit, but they have over year as well. So in terms of the US, I mean, right now we're just focused on making the best bats in the world as possible. So we can't really concern ourselves with what goes on. We just have to go by the rules. But our product is USMCA. So we've traditionally never had any duties or anything on our product. So we're hoping that remains the case. Everything is still a little bit up in the air, but we're able to kind of be nimble and kind of adjust to whatever the world throws at us. We've had stuff, obviously, with COVID and other stuff in the past. We had a tree fall through the roof at our factory 2 years ago after a tornado. We had a tornado, another different storm hit the building. We've been able to survive a lot of different things. So kind of no matter what happens in the world, that we'll be forging forward and still making the best bats out there.
Well, wishing you less tornadoes and more torpedoes moving forward. I'm going to be looking real closely next time I see a bat flip of a sand bat. I'm going to be looking closely to see if it's a torpedo or not. Thank you so much for this, Ben, and continued success.
No problem. Thank you very much.
Thanks so much to Ben once again for his expertise. Really interesting, really fascinating. I had no idea that MLB sets the rules essentially for the sport in terms of what bat you can use, and that they're giving bats to major leaguers and minor leaguers and T-ball players, it sounds like, all at the same time. If you want to give them a follow, please do at SamBatCorp, SamBatCorp is their handle on Twitter. And if you maybe want to get yourself a torpedo bat or a sand bat, full stop, sandbat.com is where you can get in contact with them. All right. We definitely made great contact on that first interview. Let's take a break. We'll take a pitch, if you will, pay some bills, come back and talk about the CPL with Commissioner Mark Noonan.
My name is Lucille Bryan.
I'm Clifton Bryan.
My grandson is a show.
And I'm so happy that you are listening to Going Deep with Donovan Bennett.
I'm so glad that you had a show. Thank you.
Thanks so much, Grandma and Granddad. And as I said before, we're going to focus on soccer, which is having a moment in our country, both at the grassroots level, but also at the professional level. Now, our domestic league here in Canada is the CPL, something that we talk about quite a bit with friend of the show, Christian Jack. And maybe we need to give commissioner of the CPL, Mark Noonan, friend of the show status. I mean, I'm claiming him as a friend, but he's been so good with his time coming on here repeatedly. So as we start season 7, kids, of the CPL, let's talk to Mark Noonan about the ongoing conversations around the league, level of play, expansion, and things they're going to be doing differently as they continue to tinker and improve moving forward. Mark Noonan on all things CPL. Let's go deep. So Mark, season 7, many great dramas and prestige shows don't get 7 seasons. So you've passed the toddler phase and now are continuing to build. At this stage in the league's growth, what really excites you and what still keeps you up at night?
Everything on both sides of that coin. You know, what really excites me is that, you know, we have this, you know, made in Canada, played in Canada, Canadian Premier League that is giving opportunities to Canadians both on and off the field that didn't exist before. So we are building the ecosystem for the sport. And when you think about our league, that we've had 11 players come through our league who represented Canada and earned caps for the full men's national team. We've had 73% of the minutes played by Canadians. And we're continuing to foster that in our league. And we've had, thousands of referee opportunities, and we're building administrators and media networks and all those sort of things that you need to really grow the sport. And that's something we're incredibly proud of. Keeps me up at night, as I said, is everything. How do we improve our product on the field, off the field? How do we sell more tickets? How do we sell sponsorships? How do we engage in our fans? How do we use our privileged platform to benefit the communities in which we live and work in? And, how do I make sure that my board of directors is happy?
Well, you said communities, plural, and that's always a conversation, certainly. I was recently talking to Christian Jack, who, whenever he talks about the sport, I leave more educated, and he was impressing upon me the importance for sometimes to lean into the word Canadian and sometimes to lean into the word premier. When you look at your league, I've said that of all the leagues we have in our country, yours is the one that truly does go coast to coast, but there's a hole there in the great province of Quebec. CPL on tour is going there. Talk to me about that decision and that market and what you're hoping to see for the second CPL on tour game.
Yeah, sure. First, I agree on KJ. Every time I talk to him, I get smarter and more knowledgeable about the sport up here. He's such an incredible, passionate and knowledgeable expert. But we know we have to get to Quebec. It's such an important part of this country, and it's also a huge hotbed for talent. And so we are in discussions in multiple places in Quebec. And we've always found, starting with our first on tour last year in Kelowna, that it's one thing to look at research, how many players are there, what sort of population is there, but there's nothing like actually going to a market and testing it out and bringing an actual product, not a friendly, but a real live regular season game into a market and seeing how we do. How does the community react to us? And I can say we've been absolutely thrilled with the support we've gotten from Mayor Marchand, his staff, the University of Laval, and Julie Dion, their athletic director, and Kevin Butler, and all the youth soccer folks. So they want us to be there. And I think we're going to have a spectacular game, and it's going to set the stage for hopefully a very long-term relationship in the province.
I'm going to do you a favor, not like everybody else, ask you the question of when are you going to expand and when you're going to expand, but I'm going to ask you about infrastructure because there is a need for continued venues in our country, and there can be challenges to getting support for them. We saw lots of interest in Kingston, for example, for a venue that could be of use for a league like yours. When you look at trying to solve that issue, what levers can you pull to make expansion more of reality? Is it multi-use? Is it collaborating with other leagues? Is it government support? Where does your mind go at trying to help solve that issue for the country?
That's a really long conversation because every market is a little bit different. What we're talking to about Kelowna, which is, may be different than what we're talking to in other markets. In some cases, you're going to get government support to help infrastructure. In other cases, you're not going to get anything and you're going to have to figure out privately, similar to what we did at Spruce Meadows in Calgary. Sometimes it's a hybrid where you've got to do a public-private situation. We're looking at all those things. We're also working with companies that can stand up stadiums pretty quickly in like 6 months that are really, really suitable to our product. And it provides everything you need in terms of locker rooms and referee rooms and premium spaces and press rooms and a great viewing experience. And we're figuring out how to do that as efficiently and economically as possible, but also put forth a highly professional presentation. And we did a little bit of that out with Vancouver. We started that. That's a work in progress. It's, I would call Vancouver phase one, but you're going to see more of that. And we're trying to make it easy to build and cost effective to build so we can get up and running.
In terms of the infrastructure and the stadiums that you have for your current organizations, is there an emphasis in terms of improvements in what exists, reallocation in terms of where teams are currently residing? Where do you look to improve in that aspect?
Yeah, there's not a lot of choices, right? It's not like we have an abundance of choices. Sadly, it's not hockey where you can find a rink on every corner. But we don't have an abundance of choices. What we're trying to do is continuously improve the venues that we're in. So this year, you'll see we reversed the camera angles in Ottawa, so they're going to be facing the rabid fans, and that's going to be a much better viewing experience for anybody watching on One Soccer as well as TSN. You're going to see new video boards in places like Vancouver to help the experience. And there's a lot of things that we're doing in premium place spaces and in our buildings. So we're working within what we have right now because we're really, there's not a lot of options if we say, hey, we don't want to play at TD Place in Ottawa because we're not the primary tenant. Well, you know what? Where else are we going to play? And we haven't found a better solution. So we're going to try and do the best we can with what we have right now while we continue to look.
You mentioned the One Soccer and TSN partnership. We saw it off the ground for the Nations League and then quickly promotion of some high-profile games during the CPL regular season. It's fascinating conversation for all leagues and broadcasters in terms of providing choice, but also maximizing revenue. When you look at the One Soccer product and people who have consistently paid, for the paywall to get those games, but also you want as many people to be able to access your product as easily as possible and greater exposure for all your brand partners. How do you, at this point of the league's growth, try to walk that fine line between the two?
Yeah, it is a fine line, and you have to think about audience segmentation. We have hardcore Canadian soccer fans who are going to buy the subscription to One Soccer. They're going to watch not just the live games, they're going to watch news and information and the shows that One Soccer brings and the great value. Check out the new studio that just came online. It's fantastic. So I would call those our hardcore. Our core fans are gonna do that. But there are millions of soccer interested fans in this country who don't yet know what an incredible product CPL is, its players and its clubs. And that's where we partner with the TSN to have a much broader lens. And hopefully we'll convert those people into fans of CPL and our clubs and our players because they see what we're doing in their communities. And we convert those into our ecosystem. And then hopefully they become subscribers of One Soccer because they can't get enough of the great stuff that we're offering. So it's really trying to be as broadly appealing as possible to the different segments of audience.
So those hardcore fans know that although the regular season is starting now, that teams have been competing for quite a while in the competition across CONCACAF this, I suppose we should say spring, even though it doesn't feel like spring in most of our country right now, has been fierce. And when we look at the emphasis of the word premier and reiterating that this is a tier one league, what were the takeaways for you on how your clubs fared against clubs from other parts of the continent?
Yeah, we are punching so far above our weight relative to how young we are and relative to, candidly, where our salary cap is. And if you look at things like how do we measure ourselves? We measure ourselves when we play against MLS clubs in the Canadian Championship. And last year, Forge knocked CF Montreal out and didn't advance to the final on the silly away goals rule. And if anybody watched the two-game tie between Forge and TFC, they'll say that Forge was a better team over those two games. So, that's a testament to what Bobby and the group have built there. Same went with Cavalry. Cavalry went out and beat the Whitecaps in Vancouver and didn't advance by the away goals rule. And so that tells you that we're making progress, but we're not going to be satisfied until we actually win that competition and get an extra berth in the CONCACAF Champions Cup. And then we go to CONCACAF Champions Cup, and you see Cavalry defeating legendary Mexican club in Pumas in the first leg and highly competitive in the second leg. You know, it just shows you how much progress that we're making, and it gives us an opportunity to not only demonstrate the quality of these Canadian clubs and these Canadian players, but it demonstrates that, you know, we are a Premier League. And, you know, people ask me, you know, what is Canadian Premier League? Is that like, you know, a minor league? I said, no, we're the exact same level as the English Premier League, Liga MX, MLS, the Bundesliga. We're just a lot younger. And, you know, just give us a little bit of time and we're going to be pretty formidable.
Well, you talked about the salaries. There's recently been an update to the roster rules and regulations and competition guidelines, including total player compensation budget. So starting in 2025, clubs are able to reach a maximum player compensation budget of just over 1.2 million. What goes into figuring out what that number is? Because I imagine you're balancing being able to compete, but also given that you're young and given that early in any startup, there's going to be lots of costs. You want to be fiscally responsible for your owners at the same time.
Yeah, that's exactly it. We're trying to find the right balance between, you know, giving our fans a great product, compensating our players fairly based on where we are economically, and having a system that is sane. You know, I see all these clubs in Europe reporting 50 million pound losses, 100 million pound losses. And, you know, Europe doesn't have a revenue problem. They have an expense problem. They're paying their labor so much that, you know, they're losing millions and millions of dollars. And that's why the Super League got invented and then shot down. And, you know, what we're trying to do is follow models in North America, you know, like the NFL, that are so stable. And, you know, the more money that the league generates, you know, we're going to share that with our players, but we're not going to get to the point where we're breaking the backs of our owners because we don't have a disciplined system in place. And so I guess what we've done is we've learned from mistakes of the past and put guardrails in a way that hopefully finds the right balance for everybody and allows us to grow systematically and not put the, you know, the enterprise at big risk.
I imagine the NSL in their first year upcoming is looking to do the same. There's naturally some soccer competition in the marketplace, but at the same time, you could argue that a rising tide lifts all boats. How do you approach the influx in inventory for everyone who's looking to support the game in various ways, with the opportunities potentially to collaborate and raise the profile of the game in Canada.
Yeah, I mean, we're very much of a rising tide lifts all boats. You know, this is about soccer, and there's been a hole on the women's side of the game because through our Canadian soccer business, we own and operate League One Canada, of which I would say, I'm guessing, the majority of players on rosters in NSL are coming through League One. We have 60 League One players on our rosters, and guys like Alistair Johnston and Richie LeRae on the national team, those guys come through League One. So there's this incredible pyramid. And on the women's side, there wasn't really a pathway in this country after League One. They'd have to either retire or go someplace else to play. And then we also represent the national team rights, the women's national team rights. So, you know, we are the beneficiary of NSL creating better Canadian players, right? So we're highly supportive of, you know, this the development of the ecosystem, and we've been trying to be as helpful as we can with them. We know how hard it is, and we wish them all the best, because it's about soccer. It's not about men's soccer. It's not about women's soccer. Is there going to be some audience overlap? Perhaps, but I think they're going to develop a really distinct identity and a distinct audience, and we're just going to continue doing what we do. And, you know, soccer grows, everybody benefits.
That's certainly the case, and we've got a busy summer calendar coming up. Obviously, the Women's World Cup in 2027, but lots of people focused on the Men's World Cup in 2026, with us being one of the three hosts. It has to be an item list for all leagues in our country to make sure you're in a position to fully maximize the world coming to our country, and potentially being able to grow the game through more interest, quite frankly, also domestically in our country. As you get closer to that date, what is the league doing, or can the league do, to take advantage of that opportunity of having a World Cup in the country, which partially is the case because the CPL exists?
Yeah, I mean, the World Cup, you know, people may not realize. I heard our great president of CONCACAF, Victor Monteleone, describe it as, you know, three Super Bowls a day for 5 weeks. That's how massive this event is, and it's going to bring incredible focus to the sport in our country, and we are doing it's going to infiltrate every part of our business. You're going to see, you know, some branding elements. You're going to see us celebrating the 1 year out. You're going to see us celebrating around the draft. You're going to see us working with Canada Soccer on Canada houses in the host cities, but also within, how do we bring that from coast to coast using the resources that CPL has. You're going to see One Soccer going to essentially be the, you know, the after TSN, who is the rights holder for the live matches, One Soccer will be diving in hugely on what's happening in that event. And so it's going to infiltrate every single part of our business. And we can't be more excited. We got to figure out our schedule. You know, we're going to continue to play during the World Cup, but be very, very cognizant that that's the World Cup is the focus. But if there's, you know, a couple days where they're not playing, or, you know, they're playing in Toronto, so why can't we have a game in Calgary when, you know, the focus of the world is on soccer? And you say, okay, Calgary is going to play their match, and then we're going to set up a viewing area at Spruce Meadows for everybody to then watch, you know, the next World Cup match, right? And so we're going to try and do those adjacency things, but by being very respectful for the tournament.
Makes sense. You talked about a revenue issue for clubs in the game. And you talked about multiple levels being impacted by things. The last question I have for you is geopolitically, what tariffs might mean for a league. Certainly, it may be a time to lead into that first word, Canadian, in terms of your league. But if we are in a different marketplace relative to recession. If it is more difficult to do things, as partners leading up to this World Cup with our friends in the United States, how much of a firewall can you build around the league, given the uncertainty that's going on geopolitically?
You know, it's I think time will tell a little bit, but one of the things that is that the ball doesn't judge, right? It doesn't care, you know, where you're from and what you look like and how tall you are and what your gender is. It just depends. You know, can you play? And you know, we're part of a global sport, right? And so, you know, I haven't seen any tariffs on soccer players, and we've done, you know, one of the things when you talk about revenue, that we are starting to participate in that global player marketplace. And, you know, some of the young players that we've developed, Kwesi Poku sold for a CPL record transfer fee to Belgium, as did Grady McDonald with a club record and Emil Gazdov with a club record last year. So we are starting to participate in this market, and thus far, nobody's put tariffs on the sale of players or the import of players, and hopefully that will remain. But yeah, we're focused on building a great league, and it's funny we have been affected by tariffs in one instance. I mentioned that we changed the camera angles in Ottawa, and so we had to build a our field boards, our advertising boards, and you know, the frames are made of aluminum, and we experienced a tax on the purchasing of those frames. So, you know, it's going to have an effect, but hopefully minimal from where we sit.
Well, there is certainly a newfound emphasis for Canadians to find ways to support local. Hopefully your league continues to be the benefit of that spirit. Lots of things for you to focus on, clearly, given this conversation. So good luck and enjoy the season.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you, Donovan. And, you know, I just say we're so excited to be representing Canada. And you know, what our fans tell us, that why they love us, is that, and I say this respectfully, is that we're not a league that's run out of New York. You know, we're a league that will go to markets like Halifax and Victoria and everywhere in between, to these real Canadian cities, and give these Canadian kids an opportunity. So hopefully that's incentive for people to come out and support them.
Thanks so much to Mark. And he talked about in that conversation the importance of the women's game for the national team, for the growth of a platform like One Soccer, but it's really important, I would argue, for the country. You may not have seen it, but there was an op-ed written by another friend of the show, Allison Sandmeyer Graves, CEO of Canadian Women in Sport, talking about the fact that Canada's women's sport boom is coming, and there's a need for accelerated action, including investment. And we've seen some milestones like PWHL and their record-breaking season in year two after a banner year one. Obviously, the launch of the Northern Super League and the debut of the Toronto Tempo is something that we've talked about on this show repeatedly. But let's go a little bit deeper, if we can, on the economic and social impact investing in women's sports has. Why that, in this marketplace, is pivotal for Canada, not just Canada's economy, but Canada's health and well-being, and what we need to do to ensure we have sustained growth and equitable opportunities for women playing sports moving forward. Let's go deep with Allison Sandmeyer Graves. So Allison, it's such an exciting time for women's sport across the globe, specifically in Canada. And I literally mean time in terms of the spring with the playoff races in the PWHL, the NSL about to start, the last WNBA season about to start before Toronto has a team. And I want to start there with the news of Serena Williams being a key investor and partner in the Tempo, but really saying to Canada in this marketplace. What symbol, either logistical or symbolic, literally, does that signify, you know, for us in terms of what this country and this market means when it comes to women's sport?
Well, a few different things come to mind. You know, I think I, like everyone else, was just so floored by that announcement, so excited by it. And when I think about, you know, other than just the Serena Williams effect, you know, what she does is interesting. And, you know, I think Canada, we tend to think of ourselves as doing great things. But then when someone like Serena Williams pays attention, it's like, oh, this, what a vote of confidence this is. Not just because, you know, she's a public figure and a celebrity, but because she's a really smart businesswoman who invests in things that she really believes are going to be successful. And she helps make them successful by her contributions, financial and otherwise. And so I think it was just such a positively reinforcing signal that this is a real opportunity, that what we've been saying about the fact that, you know, investors are going to be rewarded by investing in women's professional sport in Canada. She believes it. And if Serena believes it, I think we should all believe it.
When we talk about Canada specifically, obviously there's American, but given everything that's going on geopolitically, there's a real focus on supporting our own here in Canada, reinvesting locally. What is the potential trickle-down effect when it comes to investing in sport and women's sport in Canada because of the newfound patriotism that's been ignited?
Yeah, well, that's been an interesting kind of second conversation, is that does success look like a whole bunch of Americans investing in these teams? Partially, yes. Like, I think these teams will take the money where they can get it. And, you know, there are deep pockets in the United States and obviously a very favorable exchange rate right now. But real success has to include Canadians investing in these properties and these teams and leagues. You know, not only because it makes for a great story, but because it is, like, we should be investing. We should be believing in what we're building right here in our own country. And certainly for, if we're looking at it from a brand perspective, Canadian brands are trying to reach Canadian consumers. This is going to be a fantastic opportunity for that. And for Canadian investors to invest right here at home, there really is no better time and no better reason for it.
Okay. Now I'm going to ask you to define success. When we look at economic impact, social impact of investing in women's sports, in this pivotal moment, what does success look like?
I would say at this particular moment in the journey that we're on, you know, the economics really have to be the number one focus, because the, you know, there's a lot of excitement. You know, the PWHL has been in market for 2 years, but like the NSL hasn't even launched yet. And I'll be there like on day one, April 16th in Vancouver to see it happen. You know, the tempo still have roughly a year to go. So you know, we're just getting started. And this isn't, you know, nothing about this is certain yet at this point. Success, what does success look like? Success looks like a sustainable, thriving marketplace with these teams and leagues all up, all doing well, and doing well, not just in terms of results, wins and losses, but doing well financially. That financial model really has to start coming together. I do want to be clear, though, that success doesn't look like they're turning a profit right away, because there are lots of men's teams and leagues that do not run a profit years into operation. Obviously, that's the goal for everyone, but women's sports cannot be held to a different standard than men's sports are in this country, and we need to be really, really clear about that. But the social piece is also really important. And I think we absolutely see this great double bottom line, you know, the commercial or the economic and the social impacts emerging from women's sports. And that doesn't happen by accident. That happens when you build organizations with purpose baked right into them in terms of who you hire, how you treat your employees, the terms and conditions that you set out in your player agreements, whether or not you have a collective bargaining agreement, how you interact with your fans, how you invest and partner around social impact. And I would say that women's sports, in many respects, has set the bar for that. When you look at the WNBA in the United States and how they showed up around Black Lives Matter and other major social issues, they did it first and better than the NBA did. And so whether it's led by the athletes or led by the teams and leagues, I think there's a real opportunity to bring that purpose in, to have that social impact, which we know inherently so much of that is about girls playing sports and making sure that the presence of these teams and leagues intentionally fosters opportunities for girls along the whole pathway.
It's important you make that distinction in terms of success related to revenue, because there is a difference specifically in sports between profitability and valuation, and those things are not always exactly the same, and sometimes we judge with one and not looking at the other. You know, I think we can learn a lot, at least I believe we can, from Indigenous culture, and they have the seven generations philosophy that, you know, any decision that is made, does this make sense for all of us seven generations from now? And I think we'd be better off if we thought that way when it comes to fostering sport. When you look at this conversation, what needs to be done to have sustained growth and equitable opportunities far beyond this moment we're in right now?
Well, if we start again by talking about the professional space, that is going to come from really a whole ecosystem perspective of different investors and different supporters showing up. Again, these are businesses. They need to have revenue streams for sure from their fans, you know, buying merch and buying tickets and those sorts of things. They're going to need visibility. They're going to need to be on TV. They're going to need to be on different platforms. And creating the opportunity for people who aren't fans to become fans, for casual fans to become avid fans. there's all of these tiers of fandom that have different value for these teams and leagues. They're going to need government support. You know, there's so many different things that government can do to assist the economic model here. We've seen hundreds of millions of dollars of public funds go into building new arenas and investing in men's professional sport. Women's sport is going to need the same consideration, without a doubt. So lots of different pieces coming together. I didn't mention brands, but they always merit mentioning. You know, they're the ones who are spending a lot of the money to reach Canadian consumers through their ad dollars to with the media, to the sponsorship of these teams. So it's going to require a lot of persistence. It's going to require sustained attention on these teams and leagues. There's a lot of excitement now in the startup moment, but we're going to have to keep showing up for them in order for those to really all come together. And so much of it comes down to the fans. When it comes to the full pathway, we've seen so much progress for women in sport in so many different ways, which of course helps to fuel our success in these elite high performance spaces. But we can't ever take that for granted. I think what we're seeing across North America and around the world is that social progress is not linear. The rights and opportunities that have been fought for and won and then subsequently just enjoyed by folks can also be taken away. or, you know, or go away in other respects. And so we can't just count on the steady march of time and progress to get us where we need to be, that we have to actively intervene to create the sports system that we want for kids in our country and for our communities and our families. And we believe, given all the benefits that it produces for individuals, we believe that every single girl in this country should have access and the opportunity to participate in quality sport. Not only is that going to help them individually, but that's going to bring out the best in them as contributors to our society. It's going to enrich all of us. So continued government investment, policies to support that, sport organizations making this a priority, sport leaders, whether they be coaches or board members, committing to learning or unlearning, so that we can create spaces that are truly inclusive for every single girl in this country. That's the ultimate goal, I think. And it won't happen overnight, but I think we're headed in the right direction. And we'd really like to accelerate the pace of progress, though.
And the congregation said, amen. Really well said. You mentioned that uncertainty that we have and the lack of maybe linear progress that we can count on naturally happening the way maybe it has in the past. At times of uncertainty, people are not bullish, they're a bit bearish. And same is true for companies. We are in a time where Canadians are navigating economic, political, social uncertainty, as you mentioned. And so their direct nature might not be to look to invest in something new, women's sports or otherwise. What does the research show as to why it's a smart investment and the right time to invest?
There may be a couple of things that I would point to. Starting globally, what we're seeing, because Canada up until this point has been behind on professional sport. You know, all of our players go play somewhere else right now. All of our athletes are playing in Europe, or they're playing in the United States, or they're playing in Australia, which tells you there are professional opportunities in all of these other countries that really, in many respects, are quite similar to us developmentally, in terms of our economies, in terms of oftentimes our you know, social values. And so, so we can look globally to say, okay, what's happening elsewhere? What's working? Why is it working there? And what might it look like here in Canada, therefore, if we're to move forward? And there's so much good news to be found. You know, for the owners and the investors directly in the teams and leagues, you know, the valuations are rising. And in some cases, just atmospherically, the media rights deals that are being inked are unprecedented in their size. The fans are showing up in droves. There's so much innovation in this space. And I think what continues to be true is that sport is a really appealing investment space for a lot of investors. But what you're finding within women's sport that's different from traditional sport, which is being disrupted in many different ways, is that number one, with women's sport, particularly, you know, here in Canada, where it's really just starting up, is that you're going to get in at a really favorable price point compared to what you would see if you were investing in these long established teams and leagues. You're also going to find a very significant fan base. And that's what's really exciting here in Canada. Even before the PWHL launched, 17 million Canadians said that they were fans of women's sports. And of those fans, they're youthful, they're well-educated, they're diverse, and it's a growing fan base. The fans say, like, this is empowering, this is exciting. You know, they want more opportunities to engage. So there's demand, in other words, and frankly, unmet demand at this point, because these fans have been fans by watching the Olympics. They've been become fans by watching teams and leagues, you know, the NWSL in the United States, the WNBA in the United States. They're watching people play outside of Canada. And so you can imagine what happens when they can actually find it on Canadian broadcast and with Canadian players right in their own city, the ability to go out, the ability to find their favorite player's jersey at their local sports store. So the appetite is there, and we're seeing globally what it can look like when we invest and when we bring these things forward, just how much it pays off for people who show up, who put down the money, who can be patient. It's a little bit of a venture capital play. You know, you're not going to take your money out and then some, you know, a year later, you're going to have to leave it there for a bit. You're going to have to be a builder, truly invest in the creation of this thing. And the research and the experience shows that you're very likely to be well rewarded for it.
Well, I hope we all are well rewarded for the time and energy people like you have put into this conversation well before it was trendy. So thank you once again for coming on and giving us some better context and some inspiration.
Thanks so much for the opportunity. I'm always happy to talk about women's sports.
Thanks so much to Allison. And I mentioned off the top that op-ed. We'll put it in the show link. So if you're listening to this via radio, thank you. If you're listening to this via pod, you can go into the show notes of this podcast and find that article, either radio or pod. Please like, favorite, share, subscribe the pod, leave a review. And if you're going to give stars, you might as well give five. What's it to you? It means a lot to me that you listened this long. This was a long episode, three very different, but all great guests. Hope you enjoyed it. Talk to you again soon.